Welcome to IRL Communities and Social Media. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your fearless moderator, and I'll tell you a little bit about myself and then let each of the panelists introduce themselves because they will do a far better job than I will. My background is as a magazine journalist and book author in the technology world, and at this point, having been at South by Southwest all this weekend, I think I should say I'm a recovering magazine journalist. Because It's the social media world, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know if you knew that. but I did do a stint as editor of a magazine called Blogger and Podcaster, where we did cover social media and, it was more blogging, and I say back in those days, because we did that in 2007, 2008, and it's amazing how much the world has changed and focused on the social rather than the long-form written word. And so my job here today is to throw questions at and facilitate a conversation between people who know a lot more about our topic than I do specifically, although I have some opinions which may become apparent as I ask questions. But we're joined by a panel of folks who have done a lot of thinking about communities and social media, how they interact with one another. But I think we're going to talk a little bit about the concept of communities and neighborhoods first, and then we're going to work in some ways in which social media interact with those or don't. But the real focus, we're gonna spend a little time talking about community and neighborhood. And to do that, we have Matt Edwards from State Farm Insurance. We have Gretchen Rubin, who is an author of a blog and a book called The Happiness Project. We have Kelly Weiss, who is the executive director of Austin's Habitat for Humanity. So that's the basic bio-level introduction, but I want to go down the row and let each of them tell you something about themselves that I haven't. So let's start with Matt.
My background is not near as exciting as Shelley's, but I've been with State Farm, again, Matt Edwards. I've been with State Farm for 15 years-ish, give or take. I've sort of made a career out of riding the next new tech wave. So I was a web designer in 97, helped start our intranet, which are very exciting nowadays, but in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then recently now I'm still in public affairs on a team lead for our digital media team. So our team is reputation management, customer response, PR for social, and you know, more of the earned media side, you know, getting that quality information out to people. We don't have a budget that we're aware of, so we have to earn it all.
My name is Gretchen Rubin. I'm an author of several books. My most recent book was called The Happiness Project. And I have a blog, also called The Happiness Project, where I write about my adventures and happiness every day. And you can't think for more than about 1 minute about happiness before you start thinking about things like social relationships and how people's happiness and connects with other people's happiness. So I think a lot about issues of how people connect with each other and influence each other in terms of their day-to-day life.
I'm Kelly Weiss, currently new to Habitat. I've been here or at Habitat for about 90 days, but have a background in affordable housing. Started a nonprofit that monitors affordable housing for the city of Austin, our Miller Airport redevelopment in particular, which is a 750-acre redevelopment effort, city-owned land, master developer that has a 25% requirement for affordable housing. We have a contract with that master developer, and part of that contract is actually monitoring the blogs, websites, and social media in the Miller neighborhood to make sure all things affordable housing are in the good graces of the neighborhood and the city, which is kind of interesting. Habitat also uses social media, and we'll talk more about that. But I also have some personal stories to tell about my own neighborhood. Austin's a very neighborhood-centric city. We have neighborhood plans. We don't have a comprehensive plan. So social media in Austin plays a huge role in neighborhoods and how we connect.
Thanks, everybody. Now, see, I've learned something about each one of my fellow panelists just sitting here listening to that, so that's good. As a jumping-off point, which is kind of how this panel came to be, State Farm did a survey about people's attitudes toward their own neighbors and to neighborliness in general. And I thought we'd start by having Matt present some of those results, and we'll use that as a jumping-off point for talking about how what we think is going on in terms of our neighbors and what trends we see in communities as we go into the 21st century. So, Matt, take it away. Tell us about State Farm's research.
And as I remember, I moved the slide this time. I'm not very PowerPoint savvy, so don't be overly impressed by the four PowerPoint slides I put together. But most people aren't very PowerPoint. Don't aren't big fans of the PowerPoint anyway. So State Farm, as most of you probably know, we've gone decades on the catchphrase, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. So obviously neighbors are part of how we promote ourselves, but it really is a core of who we are as a company. Obviously, you know, we have 18,000 agents in communities all over, and they're all encouraged to be active in their communities with, you know, education, safety, and to be involved. So we're curious, with tech being so big and social becoming so big, and we connect with people online, and are we still connecting with people in our own neighborhoods anymore? And so with Harris Interactive, we put together a survey of 17,000 people, and one of the first stats that kind of had us a little worried, just as, you know, Americans and people who live in the communities around here, 46% of the people said that neighbors were worse today than they were, you know, a few decades ago, which were like, oh, maybe neighbors are kind of going south, as it were. But when you looked at the stats of what people are willing to do for their neighbors, it kind of contradicts that. So you have 45% would help them look for a job. So as many people think that neighbors are declining, are willing to help somebody look for a job. Half of them say that their neighbors affect their happiness. So again, it keeps going back against the, well, they're worse, but I really like being with my neighbors. Although you do find the other side of it, of who in here has a dog or a child or both? Okay, so I have both. So 33% of us are getting complaints, and that ended up being our number one complaint about neighbors. And as I was looking at our hashtag, there was somebody not related to this who said her neighbors, hashtag neighbors, weren't happy of her new hashtag stereo, and that's 29% of people complain about the noises of their neighbors. And you see, I think one of the shocking ones was 83% would help with financial problems. I mean, that's, you know, step up and give, you know, financially help your neighbors. But we did find a lot of people are friendly with their neighbors, know their neighbors, not a lot of them know their last names. But the fact that they're active with them. And then, I don't know if anybody's in this 10% category that would let them actually live with them for a short while. I think that had to be a pretty close neighbor. But I think as we kind of get through the panel, and Shelley expertly moderates us, we'll start to talk about how some of these stats kind of translate into our social communities and how we would do some of these same things, you know, in the world of Kickstarter and those type of things where you can donate and give money and pay it forward to a virtual community, even if you're not part of it, just because you are invested and you care about that topic in that area.
Well, let's talk about happiness then, Gretchen. You're our happiness expert, and according to State Farm research, and maybe what we all intuitively feel like, that if we have good neighbors, they can contribute to our happiness or our neighbors or our neighborhoods. So what is your take on what State Farm came up with and just generally the relationship of neighbors to happiness?
Well, it's one of the things that's clear about happiness, and, you know, kind of ancient philosophers and contemporary scientists would agree that a key and perhaps the key to happiness is strong relationships with other people. We need to feel connected. We need to feel like we belong. We need to feel like we can confide in others. And interestingly, for your statistics, is one of the, you think of that you need, one of the things you need from other people is you need to be able to get support. But actually, it's very important to be able to give support and to feel like you're part of a network where you're giving and getting support and that you're relating to people in that way. And in this time of social media, it's easy to feel like you're in a neighborhood, like a community that's virtual, that's not real. And those are very exciting. But there's something about proximity and just being actually close to people that's very, very important. It really can't be replaced. And there's a great psychological phenomenon called the mere exposure effect. It turns out that we like things better the more familiar we are with them. That's music, even nonsense syllables. We like it more the more we see it. And this is very true with people. The more you see people, even just seeing them, not even interacting with them, just like physically seeing them, the more you're likely to think that they're attractive and smart and that you like them. And so if you spend time with your neighbors, you're going to find yourself drawing closer and closer to them. just by the fact that you're seeing them all the time. And so these people that are just physically very close to us have a very important role to play, and it's really worth thinking about how can we feel more comfortable in our neighborhoods, because when you feel more comfortable with your neighbors, you feel more comfortable at home. And most of us spend a lot of our time at home. So having that feeling of closeness and giving and getting support and familiarity is something that really can add a lot to our day-to-day happiness.
I feel extremely close to all of you out here in the audience. I think you're very all attractive people.
Yes.
We're all good neighbors.
And by the end of the year, you're going to feel like they're even more attractive, even
exactly.
More wonderful.
Exactly. Fill out those surveys. I didn't really say that out loud, did I? Kelly, what's your take on, obviously... Well, I'm going to say obviously, because to me it's obvious, and correct me where I might be wrong, but in the work that Habitat does, I would assume that neighbors and neighborhoods are very important to the success of the individuals who benefit from Habitat housing, from the development that you were talking about earlier. So when you see the State Farm statistics, what's your reaction? Does it bear out what you know to be true from your own work?
Absolutely. And part of Habitat's model is a sweat equity model where we have homeowners that have to spend 400 hours not only constructing their homes, but helping their neighbors build their homes as well. So we're creating community through volunteers. Austin Habitat cycles through about 8,700 volunteers a year, which goes to, I think, Gretchen's point about having to see and touch something in order to feel like you're part of a community. And that physical piece of being able to give back. But it creates a very unique environment where you have neighbors that are building each other's houses. They get to know each other through typically what is an 18-month process, and then living in a community right next to each other, too. We do use Facebook a lot to connect, and primarily through our volunteers. So we post on Facebook to let volunteers know what's going on, what build schedules are, if we're rained out, which has been happening a lot. But I also mentioned the blogs. And in mixed-income communities that we build in, that's a real concern. There are a lot of concerns, not in my backyard, NIMBYism, about affordable housing and having mixed-income communities. We were hired by this master developer to essentially monitor these blogs to make sure that affordable housing had a good reputation, that there weren't any concerns from the market rate buyers in the neighborhood about the affordable owners or their homes. And what we overwhelmingly found is that these blogs were becoming more and more not only supportive of affordable housing, but were kind of actually acting as our watchdog for our affordable homeowners. So our homes are required to be owner-occupied, so if a neighbor thought that the owner was renting their house out, you'd see on the blog, is this an affordable home? You know, we see that it has a for lease sign in front, and it's never turned out that it was an affordable home. It's always a market rate home, which is also really interesting because you can't tell what's affordable and what's not. But what we found was the community's essentially policing for us, but in a good way, because they want affordable housing, not necessarily because they don't want affordable housing.
Well, that segues into what I was going to ask Matt, which, again, may seem a little obvious, but it's worth sort of fleshing it out. What is State Farm's interest in learning about neighbors, and what does knowing about our relationships with our neighbors, how does that help you in your business?
And this is more of the data from before. This is actually a infographic. If you want to download it, there's a URL there. You can download and look at it closer because it's a lot of data on a tiny screen and you're not that close. So, again, we want to be involved in communities. We spend millions of dollars a year in philanthropy. Habitat Humanity is one of our partners, Red Cross. But how do we take that and build that, kind of getting to the online part of that? How do we engage in the social space but still improve a physical community? So what we're running right now is a program called Cause and Effect. So we've taken $1 million and divided into $25,000 grants. And then all the ideas come from you all. It's on Facebook. Submit your idea. My neighborhood needs a playground, potholes, safer maybe street lights, whatever the case is. We're not judging. We're not deciding. Submit them all. We're going to have 3,000 by the time it's all said and done. and our youth advisory board, which is 30 young adults aged 17 to 22-ish, they're the ones who are going to pick the top 100 and put it back out to be voted on. So at the end of the day, groups like Habitat Austin potentially may help this the person who submitted this cause with $25,000 to fix whatever this issue is in that local community. So we wanted, you know, communities and individuals who want to be active in their community and are active in their community just need the financial help to do it, to tell us what it, you know, it's not a State Farm or a big business view of where it goes to help us and benefit, you know, our model. It's where the communities want the money to go. And a lot of our grant programs already do that. It's you submit a grant, but it's 15 pages, and nobody can follow half the what the forms mean. This is a very short one page. It's an any man, any person kind of submission form to improve a community anywhere.
Wait, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Have you been? What kind of things are they typically? Do people typically pick things like a park or a playground, or they pick like fix the sewer? Or what kind of things do people identify in their own community that need what? What do people ask for?
We haven't gotten them all in yet, so I haven't really read through all of them. But one thing we have found out from our youth advisory board, who they're going through them all, and we asked them, like, how many of these are viable? Because sometimes it could be – some of them we've gotten is, like, help me. It's not an individual grant. It's a help your community grant. But two-thirds of them have been, like, viable grants. So when we're at – you know, last I looked, we're about 2,000. So two-thirds of those are viable community. And if they don't have a – then we provided some partner organizations that they could select, but a vast majority are saying, well, but this group, this area in my community can help facilitate this program. Mm-hmm. So it's been great. Actually, a lot of these programs you see have, you know, there's media, you buy banner ads or whatever, but the vast majority have come through social sharing. Mm-hmm. People saying, hey, let's help our community, or did you know we can help our community? Or did you see this was happening? So we actually shut down the media buy because it wasn't driving the traffic. It was people driving the traffic, and the people interested in their communities wanting to help that was driving the traffic the most.
Go ahead. I'm just going to say, are there barriers or particular issues that you have in terms of working with the community, the cities, or the whatever the governmental entity is that's surrounding those neighborhoods where you're doing microgrants? Because, I mean, it's great to put in a pocket park or fix a pothole or whatever, but are you able to do that with, I mean, you've got the funding, but then you have to create the infrastructure opportunity to do it.
I think the only challenge we have is to be sure that the partner organization to say, hey, you know, Habitat Austin, your hand's been raised for you for this grant. So before we even get into the voting for those top 100, we'll contact everybody. Because you're right,
money.
We can't just you can't just send them a check in the mail and say, congratulations, you're building a park.
So you get the community to buy in, and they can do whatever lobbying or clearing the way with the if it's a matter of the bureaucracy of the city, or if it's a matter of an organization that's already on the ground doing this kind of work, and you're just adding funding to that pot.
Exactly. And we didn't even, you know, a lot of programs you'll see on Facebook, it's click like our page and then you can participate. And we very much want this to be about communities and individuals, not fan growth or anything. So it's not like-gated. So you don't even have to become a fan of the State Farm page to take advantage of the program. It's trying to be as open and pure to community support and neighborhoods as we can possibly be.
So I've heard a couple of, if not trends, at least developments that have to do with social media. Kelly talked about blogs and how that enables her organization to monitor what's actually going on the ground in a community with the hopes of improving things, and then Matt with the grants that State Farm is doing. Gretchen, what trends or what new things are you aware of that are happening in terms of neighbors, communities, especially having to do with the kinds of statistics that we saw where people have their tensions with their neighbors, but people want to be involved in their lives?
One of the things about social media is it's just sort of an amplifier of natural human nature. And so on the one hand, it can be a tremendous gift and a benefit because it makes it so much easier to coordinate, to spread information. We were talking about how people were using Facebook to let people know whether particular neighborhoods were at risk from wildfires, because like you're just biking around and you can actually put pictures and communicate so quickly. And so it can be a tremendous gift. And it's also, you know, if you have your neighborhood listserv or you have your Facebook page, then you can be in touch in a way that is going to help your physical connection be deeper and you get to know each other. But of course, everything, you know, it can be used for good and it can be used for ill too. And you can have things like anonymous gossip, or people sometimes don't use it to the benefit. And then I think the one thing that we all worry about with social media is, do we get distracted by the lure of our screen from the sometimes more logistically taxing aim of, like, getting together with our actual neighbors? So it's awesome if it's easy for you to say, like, hey, neighbors, come over for a barbecue, because you can send out that message in a second. But you kind of actually have to have the barbecue so that the neighbors have a chance to get together and see each other face-to-face. So like anything, it's a question of using it in the right way, and so that you take advantage of like, the power that these tools can have, but not get bogged down in some of the pitfalls that it can,
well,
that it can do.
It's funny. There's a site called City Site where there are different forums for different neighborhoods, and there's actually sections on lost pets. I've found my dog through my neighborhood listserv before in 5 minutes. It was amazing. Somebody I didn't even know, but, you know, lost small black white dog. Yes, I just saw her. She's running down the street. And, you know, and with, like,
she's running down the street.
Later, we were able
she's
to find the dog.
Tulips.
Exactly. So in ways like that, but City Site's really interesting. It actually has different lists, lost pets, lost and found, and then a rumor section that, if people hear things about neighbors or, you know, is the city doing this in the park, or is this tree being trimmed? And we have a tree ordinance in Austin. We like our trees. That those rumors can be addressed through the neighborhood blogs in that way. So there's actually, and you see some pretty amazing stuff, because it's also, you know, and I'll use this as an example too, like, did Robert Plant really move into the neighborhood?
Right.
And he did. But it's stuff like that. So you see it in sometimes positive, but sometimes negative ways too.
To take the Robert Plant story, I love this. Robert Plant lives in a neighborhood in Austin called Travis Heights. I'm from Austin as well. And he's married to Patty Griffin, who some of you may have heard of. She's also quite a well-known singer-songwriter. But I saw on Facebook about a week after Halloween, you probably saw this picture too.
Yes, that was probably my kids. We were
really
so excited.
Oh my God.
We wanted to dress up as Led Zeppelin and go trick-or-treating, but it was amazing.
So there's this picture of Robert Plant on his porch with all these little kids who had come to trick-or-treat at his house, and it was all over Facebook.
Yeah.
And that was your children?
It probably, yeah.
Oh, my God.
There were several pictures.
Amazing.
It was
just like, wow. And a lot of people knew he lived in town, but I don't think anybody really believed it.
Right.
And Austin is, just as an aside, Austin is really interesting as far, like, celebrities. We like our celebrities and everything, but we also try to be really cool and not, like, make a big deal about it, except that you can't help. Is that Robert Plant's house over there?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, because as global, and we talked about this as we were setting up the panel, as global and as much help Facebook and Twitter and all the social can be to connect you with people who you haven't seen since high school, and they live thousands of miles away. And, you know, I have a friend in Germany who I would have never seen again had not been for Facebook. I think you're seeing the actual power of it be more local.
Oh, it's amazing. I have one, and I was sharing this with Gretchen, too. I live in Travis Heights, which is right outside of downtown, and we've had a crime problem, like I think most inner-city neighborhoods. But I opened my window one day, and there was somebody standing on the other side kind of peering in, and I freaked out and called 911, and then immediately posted to my neighborhood listserv, you know, just seen, you know, 5'6", you know, dark hair, walking down Travis Heights Boulevard, be on the lookout, called 911, reported it. Later in the day, sure enough, somebody's house was robbed. And so she found me through the listserv and said, hey, I just wanted to touch base with you. My house was robbed. Called the police. Did you get a good description? And it turned out I had gone to college with her, and we knew each other in college. And she lived, like, literally a block away from me. I had no idea she was living there. And it was a horrible way to reconnect. But, yeah, we did. So.
What I wonder is, to what extent people use social media in a hyper-local or community environment, because I know most of the people I connect with on Facebook aren't even in Austin, and I have pre-existing relationships with them, either from school or work, or, you know, like Matt and I first met through podcasting, which was a hobby for both of us, and I know a lot of people that way, but I don't have those kinds of connections with my neighbors, and apparently there's some listservs I need to get on, but I'm wondering if you think, how widely you think social media is typically used in neighborhoods. And obviously, we're talking about urban environments. We're talking about Austin. We're maybe talking about bigger cities. So the second part of that question is, what is it going to take for that to trickle down into less densely populated areas? But do you think most people or many people are connecting through social media with their physical neighbors?
One example we've seen, we do a lot of monitoring, especially around hurricanes, tornadoes, major catastrophes. So last year during the Joplin, Tuscaloosa tornadoes, we ran across a page where it was a guy who, and tornadoes can carry debris 50, 100 miles away, right? Especially small pieces of paper. So she was finding photos in her front yard. Mm-hmm. And the storm didn't hit her, but 100 miles away, here's this photo of his family. I don't know who this is. So she started a Facebook page, just grassroots, saying, hey, I found this photo. If you find photos, post them and see if we can connect people back with their photos. Because that's one thing insurance can't replace is a family photo. And she had thousands and thousands of people who became fans of this page. And we even reached out to see if we could help, but it was organically growing on its own. So, you know, in a time of a catastrophe or crisis, you know, Red Cross can be there with shelters, and we'll be there, you know, with our claims people. And that's good for the big things, but the home, local things, I think, really get solved by the people who are living those experiences, even, like, when they're going on. And I think a local community really is the best source for that.
And we saw that in the recent Texas wildfires at Steiner Ranch. Literally, they had to evacuate that community almost immediately. There was somebody who took his bike and his family and his dog were in traffic getting out, and he said, you know, we're just sitting in traffic. I'm taking my bike and riding through the neighborhood. And in doing that, and Gretchen mentioned it, he was on Facebook basically saying, you know, this block of Steiner Ranch is okay. This house is, and then people started responding back, you know, I left my dog. Can you go and get my dog? And it was just amazing how that community came together on Facebook. We saw the same thing in Bastrop, which was really interesting because it was a more rural environment and not everybody had, you couldn't drive down the streets in Bastrop. It's a very, very wooded, piney area, timber box, so to speak, in one of the worst wildfires we've seen. But it was through Facebook that a lot of people were notified that they needed to evacuate.
Sure, since we have a fairly small crowd, go ahead.
Just for my understanding of your conversation, I'm not from Austin. And you talked about the neighborhood blogs. Are these things that have sprung up, for, you know, haphazardly, or is there some system? You say they're...
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah, tell
us about those.
I think it's both. I mean, I know in Travis Heights we've had our listserv for... I've lived there 15 years, and as soon as we were... I got an iPhone, I guess, which was I don't know how many years ago. The listserv was there. And before that, it was the Coffee Klatch. And the Coffee Klatch still meets, but we know when to meet because of the listservs. The city also promotes...
Does the city provide the listserv?
No. So that's all neighborhood-based. It is.
So is there a volunteer group that does
it? Yes. We generally have a volunteer... administrator, I guess, so you have to be accepted.
Is it through your neighborhood association? Because Austin has a lot of neighborhood associations.
You know, it's not. It's actually not. And it's really interesting because there's a separate neighborhood association listserv, but it's like it's not the listserv that has, you know, that everybody's on to find your dog kind of thing.
Totally unscientifically, just from what I've noticed in New York City where I live, where there's a lot of different neighborhoods, just like in a lot of physical neighborhoods, there's kind of like the mayor, who's just sort of the self-appointed person who's just like, I'm the one who's going to greet the new people, and I'm the one who's sort of going to call the city. And people step forward in that way. And I think that's what sort of happens online, too, that it's that like a neighborhood that has that mayor... who's also technically savvy, somebody steps forward and then everybody else, but you need that person to play a role. And if your neighborhood doesn't have that person, then maybe you never get that kind of cohesiveness. And one thing I wanted to point out from your statistics, I don't know if they were on the thing, was that among Americans 66 and older, 65% know at least a fair amount of their neighbors, compared with 36% of people ages 18 to 34. Mm. And I think that part of the thing about neighbors and the changing of neighbors is that people move so much more, especially when they're younger. And when you're moving, you don't get to know people over time. And also, when everybody is staying there and somebody new comes in, that person's sort of the center of attention. But if everybody's moving in and out, then sort of nobody has that feeling of needing to get to know everybody. And so I think that that's one thing to think about is even if you're moving and maybe you're only going to be someplace for a couple of years, it really is worth your time to try to get to know your neighbors, at least by their first names. Maybe you can't master their last names. Or to figure out, is there a listserv? Because maybe it's not going to be totally obvious how you connect with everybody. But having that feeling of feeling connected to your neighborhood, even if it's not someplace that you're going to live for the next 60 years, is really going to add to your sense of connection to your community and your sense of relatedness to other people.
In Bloomington, we just use a hashtag Blono. Is Bloomington normal? So we don't have a listserv. We just kind of our self-appointed mayor.
But how do people know about it?
Well, it's only used on Twitter for the most part, but it just sort of has organically to the point that you start to see, like, business and more community, official community people use it instead of just, like, the Twitter geeks that are out there. So, yeah, Blono has almost become, is pushing into, like, the official. So, you know, we search that just to see what's being said. So if there's a storm or something, people will just start searching hashtag Blono to see who's saying what about the storm. So it's another way of doing that.
One interesting thing that happens in my neighborhood, we have a neighborhood association, which is it's a fairly big neighborhood near the University of Texas, but and there's a newsletter, and there may be a listserv. I honestly don't know, and I'm going to go look because I'm curious now. But my neighbors on our street, I live on a fairly small street. There are about 15 houses. Somebody just circulated a piece of paper and said, let's have your email address and your contact info so that we can do just on our street, you know, it's good for crime, it's good for, you know, so-and-so's in the neighborhood soliciting and, you know, or there's a, we have a parking permit. Austin has a thing where you can create a permitting system so that folks who don't live on the neighborhood can't park on the streets because there aren't very many garages in our neighborhood. So there are a couple of reasons for us to connect, but probably not beyond the single street we live on. So even in a neighborhood, you have a smaller slice that you've cut out. But it's a listserv. It's not Facebook. It's not using what we think of as the newfangled social media tools. So it seems like people are finding solutions that work for their particular needs and work for their particular spaces, because I'm not Facebook friends with anybody on my street, but I have a lot of email addresses, and we exchange information about who's got new cats, kittens that they'd like to get rid of.
Yeah. Girl Scout cookies?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Gretchen, I'm sorry, Kelly, can you talk a little bit more? We were talking about the blogs earlier that you monitor for Mueller and for Habitat. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about where did those blogs come from? Were they neighbor-generated? Did you guys put them together? And then you mentioned a few things about what monitoring those blogs has given you in terms of information. But what, in general, is going on those blogs, and where do they come from?
The more formal blogs were actually set up by the master developer. And so this is a 750-acre redevelopment. And so they're very interested in promoting the development and what's going on. There have been, I guess, about 500 homes built out there so far. There's another 2,000 homes to build, so there's always dirt being moved. Mm-hmm. Neighbors have questions about, you know, when is the HEB, which is a new grocery store, moving in? That was just announced. Why is the pool closed? And so, you know, that's announced.
Well, you know, just as an interruption, do you think that, like, now that local media is kind of drying up, that the blogs are sort of like, because there's not going to be a newspaper article in your local newspaper about what's happening with the supermarket, but maybe this is becoming the new...
Well, yeah, and I mean, and I've stopped taking the newspaper. I mean, it's kind of like...
A lot of communities just don't have the kind of coverage.
And I look at it online and whatever. So it was, in this case, in this master development, it was actually driven by the master developer. They've got a PR firm that also monitors the big picture to make sure everybody's happy and the residents are happy and that marketing for this development is going well. But it's reporting on, like I said, there is a section that's rumors. There's a section that's homes for sale. There's a section on babysitter, you know, need a babysitter is a big one. Pets are a big one. Different types of book clubs. There's a book club section as well. And then the pool is a big one. You know, why is the pool closed? That kind of thing.
Does anybody moderate that or do, I mean, I'm not saying that they should. I'm in fact saying the opposite. But do people pretty much feel free to communicate in any way they want to?
They do, and the PR...
Can they be anonymous?
They can be anonymous, I believe. They do... it's very difficult for that PR firm to step in and take something down off the blog. And so, if, especially if there's criticism, because there's automatically backlash against posts being removed. So they've taken a more proactive approach into trying to deal with whatever issues are brought forward, the affordable housing piece being one. And so there, if there's something on affordable housing, that's our little niche, and we try to address whatever concerns or police reports, or not police reports, but policing of the affordable housing is brought to our attention, we can then reach out and address it in a positive manner. So they are being monitored, but you know, one thing we learned early on is if you pull something down that's negative, it's worse. So the conversation is allowed to be free-flowing, and you know, we realize that criticism is part of that. Mm-hmm. We've just got, you know, our job is to be there to kind of slant it to the positive.
Do you, this is for anybody on the panel, but I'll start with you, Kelly, but are there, in general, have you seen any negative aspects to social media as the communication method in terms of neighbors? We see that, according to the statistics, 46% believe that their neighbors or their relationships with neighbors are worse than they used to be, and I'm wondering if either the prevalence of social media in people's lives or specifically in terms of their relationships with neighbors has any downside.
You know, I think it's I think it mirrors what we saw before social media. So there's always that house on the block that doesn't mow their grass and everybody else does. There's always the barking dog. There's always the
house full of teenagers.
House full of teenagers with loud music. You know, there's always the people that built an addition onto their home and they shouldn't have because it's against city code. So you start to see that creep in. But I would say that was going on before social media. You always had that the Kravitz effect from kind of Bewitched happening before social media. It's just another outlet.
Anybody else?
I'm going off script, so Gretchen, I'm going to apologize.
Go.
Surprise.
He's going to go wild now.
What I'm curious about when we start talking about some of the negative that's out there, and kind of to a larger extent, something you hear about the cyberbullying and all that, how does some of that affect the neighborhood and communities when it's like, what I may have said over my back fence to my neighbor, now everybody sees that, oh, well, you don't mow your lawn. I mean, that's kind of a simple one, but now it's gone beyond just, you know, a little coffee group in the morning or over the fence. Does that impact people's happiness then?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is a problem generally with social media, which is that it's permanent and it's written and it's often can be anonymous. And so you can get much more dramatic behavior than you would get if somebody were face-to-face or they were in an actual social situation, because when you're just by yourself, you behave differently than you would if you were in a group. So I think it can amplify. But, you know, the more people feel like they know who they're communicating with, and the more they feel known themselves, then I think it is. But, I mean, the thing is, you know, they say, Sartre said, hell is other people. But heaven is other people, too. And so all these things, you know, you get the good and then you get the bad. You get the gossip and then you get the helpful information. And so part of it is just figuring out how we manage our normal human nature with these tools that can kind of let us run amok further than we used to, but they can also let us do more good and connect in a more deeper and quicker, faster way. So there's great opportunity, but we just have to be mindful of how it can also be used and negatively.
And that's one of the trends I've seen. When you do see a negative post, it's amazing. A lot of times, I mean, and we've learned, we'll wait.
People will rush in and police
themselves. And so, so for every negative kind of twist that's out there, there's always somebody that's, wait, no, that's not true, or yes, but it really didn't happen this way, or, you know, that kind of thing. So people are self-policing.
Kelly, I'm wondering about, I'm going to go off script too, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. I'm going to ask this last question, and then let the panelists do a little wrap up they want to do. And then, if any of you have any questions, please step up to the mic and ask them. But I'm wondering, Kelly, as far as folks who are Habitat clients who are building their own houses and coming into new neighborhoods, have you done anything with those folks in terms of encouraging them them to make overtures to their neighbors and to become parts of neighborhoods, either physically or in terms of social media, because you obviously have some apprehension among people who, whether it's affordable housing or whether it's a Habitat client or something, the unknown is always scary to people who have a pre-existing interest in the neighborhood. So I'm wondering if there's education that goes on for the folks that are new to the neighborhood and might experience negativity that they don't really warrant.
We do spend a lot of time educating Habitat buyers, all of our affordable buyers, in terms of being good neighbors. And a big piece of that is just awareness. And Austin is a neighborhood planning city. We will have a comprehensive plan, but basically Austin's plan through neighborhood planning. So we tend to stick tight, and we want to make sure our residents understand where their neighborhood association is, encourage them to get involved, encourage them to be involved at City Hall. Austin is also, you know, very prolific in the term. We study everything, and I think that's part of being a university town. We're blessed and cursed by stakeholder groups, which is also in part and parcel why I think we have such a hard time moving off-center. But we do encourage community engagement for our homeowners through those avenues, which I think is really important because it tends to, quote unquote, kind of mainstream that affordable buyer into a mixed income community, especially when we're focusing on home ownership. They're generally coming out of a rental housing environment. Home ownership can be very different. There are different expectations. Social networks are often different in ownership communities. And so that is something we focus on.
Well, let me throw it open to everybody and just ask, this will be the seed question, but feel free to say anything you want to that we haven't really touched on as regards this issue. What trends or developments do you see affecting neighbors, whether they be in terms of physical relationships or, I guess, social media?
Well, one trend I think is just the moving and two-income families, which doesn't have to do with social media, but just has to do with like how much time and energy people can engage with their neighborhoods. And you know, and sometimes people are like, oh, well, because of social media, people aren't connecting. I mean, really, to me, when I think of like the long range, like the change in neighborhoods, I think it's television. You know, if you read an account of what it was like to live someplace before television, there was just like a lot more people sitting on the porch, people having parades, people just hanging out because people were more bored. Like they, you know, they just got out. And so I think it's not really social. I think social media has a lot to offer and can be a distraction. And I think TV is the thing that has kept people inside and kept them from going face to face as much. But also now, just because of the more mobile workforce and because of two income families, it's just hard. And which is why I think it's important to remember how much our neighbors do matter to our happiness, and how it really is worth our time and our effort to just step outside and to get to know somebody's name and to pet their dog and to buy those thin mints and to play a role, because in the long term it does you can help somebody and give support, you can get support, and you can use all these new tools to help you play that, to make it easier to engage and to join a community and play a role.
And I think you're seeing a space where people can reach out for, whether it's to learn about my neighbors, because maybe I'm not comfortable going door to door to meet my neighbors, or to seek help for something that maybe I'm embarrassed about or don't know where else to turn and don't want to ask anybody.
Don't know where to go.
And then, I know this happens in my house right now. It's a big issue. You know, all the screen time. I mean, the TV was the biggest thing that kept a lot of us inside. But now you sit in front of the TV, in front of your iPad, with your computer open, and next thing you know, you have a family of four sitting around totally disconnected in the same room. So I think from the family aspect, it's a big push now.
It's like turn on the sprinkler and go outside.
Yeah, not only turn, you know, unplug the whole house and, you know, hope the batteries go dead.
Yeah.
Any questions from the audience? Come on up. Don't be shy. Because otherwise we'll have to do a dance number that we haven't prepared, and no one wants to see that. I think it is.
I think it may be now.
You have to lean right into it.
So I appreciate the perspectives. I just came just pure out of interest of being, you know, living in a neighborhood. What I'm wondering is, you know, with all of these social media, there are advantages and disadvantages. There's different affordances for each of them. they're more geared towards your local neighborhood versus your whole city, like the Twitter. People do, you know, hashtag ATX for Austin, but like that's the whole entire city. So, and there's issues of the permanency, there's issues of not being anonymous, like writing something like you're going to be out of town, you know, and having people see that. So I wondered if there was, or perhaps there's a need for, kind of a white paper, and this goes to the other gentleman's question. So as, I mean, lots of us live in neighborhoods that are already established and have some of these things through the just the organic development, but there's also neighborhoods that are being built, new ones, and I wondered if there was some kind of white paper that was kind of pulled all these things together and said, here are, you know, here are the things you need to think about in a neighborhood, and here's all the, because like listservs are, that's a very old technology, right? But, you know, we use those in my neighborhood as well. But, you know, what, when would a listserv be most appropriate or possibly most inclusive? When would Facebook, when would Twitter, when would, there actually in Austin has a wonderful print city newspaper that goes to all houses, which is wonderful. You know, kind of laying things out, and those, that could be given to people who move into these areas. It could be given to developers that are developing new areas. It could be given to your the clients for, you know, Habitat clients, et cetera, et cetera. I think that, and I just wondered if that existed, and I also thought that might be a wonderful
State Farm
initiative.
Yeah, there we go. Out to give 20.
I just wrote it down.
That's a great idea, because it's sort of like a community can form, but you need that like sort of first thing, and if nobody kind of feels like it's their role to start the hashtag, it never happens, but if it happens, then it could kind of ignite this community feeling. It's a great idea.
People themselves don't necessarily know the risks of a lot of these things.
That's true too.
Or someone's like, they say something and then someone else is like, well, you know, this is public.
So they'd sort of get a cheat sheet, which is like, this is what you're using. Remember, it's public. And here are the different things. If you want to hear about your block, there's the thing for the block. And if you want to hear about what's going on in this development, then there's this. Yeah. It's a great idea.
Just so people know that.
Because like you say, you might not even know it's there. And like 80% of your neighborhood is on it, and you just never hear about it.
And I do recommend anybody who says, and this is a little more, businesses do this a lot more often, but I think it would apply to a community page of community guidelines that sort of outline, here's the expected behavior, and this is why we will remove you, whether it's a Facebook wall or something else, because this is not a place to swear. It's not a place to attack others. So those are as important. But I love this idea.
Yeah. I think also if you have guidelines, somebody or bodies are more likely to take leadership, because if everybody in the neighborhood is looking around wishing somebody would step up and kind of be the community manager informally, and there's no guideline, I mean, people have a wide variety of tech savvy, and people are busy.
That's true.
And if those guidelines existed, somebody, well, that doesn't look so hard. Right. I could probably manage a Facebook page.
Yeah. Right. You fantasize that people need to have all this advanced expertise. But in fact, if you knew that all you had to do was, do X, Y, Z, you're like, man, I could do that.
Yeah.
That's a great suggestion.
Another question?
Yes. Hi. My name is Jen Martin, and I work for AARP. I manage the AARP Foundation, social media, as well as Creating Good, which is all the volunteering arm of AARP. We are finding the AARP Foundation focuses on four things: hunger, housing, income, and isolation. And isolation of seniors seems to be the most difficult for us to tackle. So, and a lot of seniors obviously aren't on social. Mm-hmm. 45, Facebook, women 45 to 65, yes, but we're looking at 65-year-olds and above who are in their houses, and they have, they're not on technology, they're not syncing, they're not on Twitter, they're not on Facebook. And I'm just wondering, how would you address that kind of neighborly, getting in there and talking to these people?
That's a good question.
Aren't going to the senior center because
they don't
have families, they don't have anybody. You know, the only connection they might get is, the Meals on Wheels, drop off of food, which is starting to kind of work with them and, look into getting them into social media, but there's a huge, lack of just
they're not getting the connection that they need. And isolation is a huge issue with the people 65 and older. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas or suggestions of how to reach out to those people.
I'm speaking from personal experience. I have my great grandmother and my mother in town. My kid's great grandmother's 90 years old, and macular degeneration. She can't see. Meals on Wheels comes, and it's mainly for the social interaction. She's still sharp, but she can't see. And so we got a family iPad. That was the big Hanukkah gift this year for us. And my daughters will try to show her, look, you know, Gaga, you can do this on social media. And she's like, what? You know, you mean you can talk, other people can talk to you through this little, like, thing? And it's, I don't know the answer to that. I think it's really interesting. To me, it almost becomes more of a neighborhood awareness of who the elderly people are in your community so that they're watching out for them. Because that technology gap, I know in my personal situation, there would be no way I could ever bridge it. So to me, it's just, and we kind of do in our neighborhood actually know who the older people are. And so it is. And so if we haven't seen them out or so-and-so hasn't watered her plants
today.
So maybe
that's the way, is it's more that the people who are on the social media making sure that that's an issue,
yeah,
that's highlighted as an area of concern, which is let's make sure that we're monitoring, looking for signs that there might be a problem or going out of our way to say hello, because if they can't get on themselves. But it's an interesting question whether people will age differently.
Yeah.
Because learning it when you're 55 is different, and maybe the experience is something that will
change,
be addressed kind of with time because people have this facility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My question is actually a little bit of an extension of that question. I live in a neighborhood in North Austin that is lower income and doesn't have a lot of people on social media, and we're also divided by language barriers. Probably the majority of the neighborhood speaks Spanish, and there are a lot of us who are interested in doing things to connect the neighborhood more, but we may not speak Spanish. So I was wondering if you guys could talk to some ideas about helping the neighborhood connect offline. I think that's going to be really important for our neighborhood and kind of what that would look like. I know it used to be maybe somebody brought a Jell-O mold to their next door. I think that there is an idea of the suspicion of like bringing food over to your next door neighbor, like cookies or whatnot. So just any ideas or suggestions?
I live in a smaller community, well, a large community, but a smaller neighborhood. It's an older neighborhood. And to be honest, I know we're talking social and all the online pieces, but literally, and again, I think it goes back to whether it's online and real, you need that champion, you need that self-appointed mayor or whatever you want to call them. And we have that in our community. And it is the old-fashioned drop it in the mailbox of every, you know, piece of paper, come to this event. And some days it may be an ice cream social. Some there's the Fourth of July. There's the Fourth of July parade. Bring the kids by. And it's nothing over the top or fancy. But I think if you want to try and throw some social into there, when you're dropping off a traditional flyer, say, oh, and by the way, if you're on Facebook, we all gather here, or here's our neighborhood's hashtag or something. But that's really worked in our neighborhood, just kind of the, you know, going back to print.
And I'd say, too, in Austin, radio for the Hispanic community is kind of their television kind of outlet. So the radio is a huge way that the Hispanic community stays connected. The other thing I would say, in doing a lot of work with neighborhoods in a former life when I was at the city kind of doing neighborhood planning, is food is actually a great way to make it's the one thing we all do. We all eat. And so anything around food, while I could see dropping off something to somebody's personal home raises attention, but food at a community event is
like a
great
potluck.
Kind of like it's a potluck. I mean, and it's a great way to bring people together because it's something we all do.
One Halloween, my across the street neighbors who are dear friends, and unfortunately they don't live there anymore because they had brilliant ideas like this. Halloween evening, when the kids were coming out to trick or treat, they wheeled a portable Weber grill out into the end of the cul-de-sac, and they put some meat on, and you could have what you wanted, but we were taking donations, and I can't remember if they were going to give it to UNICEF or some charity, but the idea was not only would they gather a little money, but it attract the kids who are going door to door and getting their candy and trick-or-treating, especially since parents now take kids trick-or-treating, whereas when I was a kid, you just went out by yourself. The parents would come and gather, and we would all just, we met around the barbecue pit, we had beers, we had, you know, a little charity, a little communication, and people connected in a more relaxed way, especially because they were with their kids, than they would have if we had said, we'll come to even a potluck. We've done that sort of stuff too, but a potluck, somebody's going to be out of town, somebody's not going to have a dish, but most people in the neighborhood were going to take their kid trick-or-treating that night, and it was just so much fun, and we've talked about doing it again. It's just, you know, and that worked for our little street because we're on a little cul-de-sac. It might not work for every neighborhood, but...
Yeah, don't try that if you live on a highway, please.
Yeah.
No. Just a general safety message.
Hi, my name is Joy. I'm from Austin as well. I'm kind of on that same line. I mean, I live on the east side of town, which those of you all from Austin know that it's rapidly changing. There's people like me who live over there, who used to live over there. So, for lack of a better word, a lot of gentrification is happening. And one of the biggest struggles I have, I also work for a nonprofit. We primarily work with low-income folks. Is, social media appropriate? Because I think, like you said, Gretchen, at the beginning, social media can't really take place of just meeting people face-to-face and having that physical proximity. And so for someone who's working in an area that not everybody, you know, is white and drives a really nice car and has two, you know, incomes, you know, does social media really work in that area where some people don't use internet, some people don't speak English? I mean, so is that really something that can
be, you know, I think it's tough. And I'll use an example. I don't know where you live, but East Cesar Chavez, ECC neighborhood, has a Facebook page that's just for businesses there, local businesses. And what's been interesting is there are a lot of it's a traditionally Hispanic neighborhood, a lot of Hispanic-owned businesses. And what's amazing to me is you're starting to see, of course, more coffee shops, more bars. Before it was not that kind of local business, but it's a way for local businesses to come together. And I think because of that, doing outreach to the community is also a way to kind of touch, whether it's that new, you know, $500,000 home that's next to the, you know, four square, you know, home that's still $200,000 because the land's worth that much, but the house isn't. But so we're seeing it in some ways on the east side through businesses connecting, which I think has been interesting. I noticed on the East Cesar Chavez listserv today, there was a community celebration around Cesar Chavez, actually, is coming up. So Cesar Chavez Day will be celebrated. So that's another way, I think, that low-income people, because that's primarily the population we deal with, too, they're all going to those businesses for something. And it may not be the coffee shop that they're buying coffee at, but it's the corner store, or it's the Quinceanilla dress shop, for instance, in East Cesar Chavez that they're frequenting.
You mean so the social media isn't being used by the people, the residents, but it's being used by the businesses that are in that part
that
of that.
Exactly. Yeah. And talking about
and
how they connect with customers.
That. So then exactly. it gets them through that. So
exactly.
there's like that intermediate step.
That's a great point, because we actually have an agent I talked to at our convention who he is the mayor of, and he started a little, I think it's a monthly sort of, you know, community carnival fair type thing. Mm-hmm. And it's grown to the point where he's worked with other businesses via social. So a lot of what he's doing with the businesses is over social, but they put this together for the community in the area. So then that brings the community together, regardless of if the community was in the social media space.
Using it themselves.
Exactly.
Individually.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're almost about out of time.
One last question.
But that's what I was going to say. We have time for one more.
My name's Carol, and I'm actually from Chicago.
Illinois. All right.
Because State Farm has opened up something in a highly densely populated neighborhood in Chicago called Next Door, and it is a physical building that seems to be catering just to the local population through just kind of social stuff. So there's yoga and there's bike rides and workshops about money and all kinds of things that seem to be, I don't know what the purpose of it is. I was, you know, suspicious in the beginning, but people who work there are not selling products and not allowed to sell, but it seems to sort of be kind of on brand with State Farm and the neighborhood kind of thing, but I'm wondering, you know, how that's doing and if a physical space bringing people together, as a couple of you mentioned, really is also needed, and because social does not replace that. And I'm curious if how that's doing so far, you know.
Well, thank you for bringing it up. I should have actually probably made a note about that, huh? Yeah, so Nextdoor is actually a pilot, a test we're doing right now. It's come out very well. We started in Chicago, more because of the proximity to Bloomington and our corporate headquarters that we can have access to it. But it is run by State Farm employees, but we do not sell. It is exactly what, as you explained it, which is perfect. It is a community location. If you need to have a meeting or a conference, you can go use a meeting space. They do sell coffee. But you can get coffee, and it is purely there as a community asset resource. Granted, there's the brand recognition because it's from State Farm, but it's not a place you go to get pitched product and sold things. It's just there to be a neighborhood resource. And I'm not specifically on that project, but I would assume that if this goes as well as it has been going, we would start to see those start showing up in other communities as well.